decades of my absence has been drowning in the Marxist broth of history from the soup kettle of democracy, be capable of peering over the edge of his own bowl. I have no intention of casting any reproach upon the honest labourer or farmer. How should the simple man protest when so-called professionals and academic non-entities have for 6 decades been proclaiming from the lecterns in their temples of knowledge that the Führer is dead? Who would hold it against the man who, amidst his daily struggle for survival, cannot find the strength to say, "Where is he then, the dead Führer? Show him to me." Or the woman, for that matter. But when the Führer suddenly reappears in the place where he always was, in the capital of the Reich, the confusion and disorientation which strikes the Volk is as paralyzing as the astonishment. And it would have been perfectly understandable had I too spent days, weeks even, in utter bewilderment, crippled by the incomprehensible. But fate decreed that it should be different with me, that as a result of a vast amount of effort and enormous deprivation over harsh yet instructive years, I should be able early in life to form a reasoned outlook, forged in theory but hardened into a finished weapon on the battlefield of practice, an unwavering viewpoint which had consistently governed my life and work ever since. Even now, there was no need for newfangled or casual tinkering. On the contrary, my grounded perspective helped me achieve an understanding of both the old and the new. And so it was the Führer principle which ultimately liberated me from my fruitless hunt for explanations. Having spent one of the first nights tossing and turning in my armchair, unable to sleep after those strenuous hours of reading and ruminating on my plight, all of a sudden I was struck by a flash of understanding. I sat up bolt upright, my eyes wide with enlightenment as they surveyed the large jars of colourful confectionery and everything else inside the kiosk. It was crystal clear. In her own inscrutable way, fate herself had intervened in the course of events. I slapped my forehead. It was so obvious that I reproached myself for not having realized it earlier, particularly as this was not the first time that destiny had taken hold of the rudder. Had it not been exactly the same in 1919, at the nadir of German misery and hardship? Did not an unknown corporal rise from the trenches in that portentous year? Despite being afflicted by poverty, abject poverty, did not a brilliant orator emerge from the desperate multitudes from where one might have least expected? Did not this orator also reveal a rich hoard of knowledge and experience amassed during those darkest of days in Vienna and born of an insatiable curiosity which, from early childhood, spurred this young man, keen of mind, to devour everything relating to history and politics? The most valuable information, stored seemingly at random, but in fact carefully accumulated morsel by morsel within one man. And did not this man, this inconspicuous corporal, upon whose lonely shoulders millions placed their hopes, did he not smash the shackles of Versailles and the League of Nations, withstand with God-given ease the conflicts forced on him with Europe's armies against France, against England, against Russia? Did not this man, who was said to possess no more than a mediocre mind, lead the fatherland to the highest peaks of glory in the face of unanimous judgment by self-professed experts? This man, of course, was none other than myself. My ears were pounding. Each single event, each single occurrence from back then was by itself more improbable than everything which had befallen me over these past 2 or 3 days. Now my razor-sharp gaze pierced the darkness between a jar of bullseyes and one of sugar drops, where the bright light of the moon soberly illuminated my brainwave like an icy torch. Of course, for a lonely warrior to lead an entire people out of a slough of errors is a wondrous talent, which could appear only every 100 or 200 years. But what was fate to do if she had already played this priceless trump card? If, amongst the human material available, there was not a single soul with sufficient presence of mind. Then, for good or evil, he must be snatched from the clutches of the past. And although this was unquestionably a miracle of sorts, it was comparatively easier to achieve than the task of fashioning a sharp new sword from the inferior metal at hand. Just as this stream of insight began to calm my erratic thinking, a new concern swelled in my alert mind. For this conclusion brought with it another, like an uninvited guest. If fate had been forced to play a cheap trick, there was no other way to describe it. The situation, however tranquil it may seem at first glance, must be even more cataclysmic than before, and the Volk in even greater danger. This was when I understood that now was not the moment to waste time on academic arguments, to agonize pedantically over the how and the whether, seeing as the why and the that were by far the more important considerations. And yet there was still one question that remained unanswered. Why me? Given that so many heroes of German history were waiting for a second opportunity to lead the Volk to new glories. Why not a Bismarck, or a Frederick the Great, a Charlemagne, an Otto? After brief deliberation, the answer came so easily that I almost chuckled at how flattered I felt. For the Herculean task that was waiting to be undertaken here truly seemed as if it would put even the bravest men, the great and greatest Germans, in their place. All on his own, without party apparatus or executive power, one man in particular was being entrusted with the job. The man who had already demonstrated that he was capable of cleaning out the Augean stables of democracy. But did I want to put myself through all those painful sacrifices a second time? Swallow all the privations and derision again, nay, gulp them down with disdain? Spend my nights in an armchair beside a water urn in which sausages are heated up during the day for human consumption? And all this for the love of a people which, in the struggle for its destiny, had already left its Führer in the lurch once before? Whatever happened to the Steiner offensive? Or Paulus, that ignominious blackguard? At this point I needed to keep my rancor in check, to separate reasonable anger from blind rage. Just as the Volk must stand by its Führer, so the Führer must stand by his Volk. Under the right leadership, the simple soldier has always done his best. How can he be upbraided if he is unable to march loyally into enemy fire because cowardly, neglectful generals surrender his opportunity to die an honorable soldier's death? Yes, I cried into the darkness of the kiosk. Yes, I want to, and I will. Yes, yes, and three times yes. The night answered with black silence. Then, close by, a lonesome voice hollered,
"Exactly! They're all a bunch of arseholes!"
I should have taken this as a warning. But if, back then, I had known of the ceaseless efforts, the bitter sacrifices that I would ultimately have to make, the sheer torment of the unequal struggle, I would have merely sworn my oath more heartily at twice the volume. Chapter 5. The first steps were hard work. There was no question of any physical weakness on my part. The fact was, I felt like an imbecile in the newspaper vendor's borrowed clothes. Trousers and shirt were just about passable. He had brought me a clean pair of blue cotton trousers, which he called jeans, and a clean, red-checked cotton shirt. I had rather been expecting a suit and hat, but when I took a closer look at the newspaper seller, I had to admit that my reasoning had been deluded. This man did not wear a suit in his kiosk, and, from what I had observed so far, there was little of the bourgeois about the dress of his clientele either. Hats, just to complete the picture, seemed to be uncommon. With the modest means at my disposal, I decided to lend as much dignity as I could to the ensemble by eschewing his bizarre habit of wearing the shirt loose outside the trousers, instead pushing it as far down my waistband as possible. The trousers were slightly too big for me, but with my belt I was able to fasten and hitch them up tightly. Then I fixed my strap over the right shoulder. It was no German soldier's uniform, but the overall look was at least one of a man who knows how to dress decently. The shoes, on the other hand, were a problem. Having assured me that he knew nobody else who took my size, the newspaper vendor had brought along an outlandish pair belonging to his adolescent son. Whether they could rightly be called shoes was a matter open to debate. They were huge, white, with massive soles. I felt like a circus clown. I had to resist the impulse of throwing them straight back into the face of that half-wit. "I'm not wearing these," I said. "Why, they make me look like a buffoon." No doubt insulted, he made a remark to the effect that he disapproved of the way I wore the trousers, but I ignored this. I wrapped the legs of the jeans tightly around my calves and pushed them into my boots.
"You really don't want to look like other people, do you?" the newspaper vendor said.
"Where do you think it would have got me if I'd always done everything like so-called other people?" I retorted. "And where would Germany be?"
"Hmm," he said, silenced by my comment. He lit another cigarette and said,
"You could see it that way, I suppose."
He folded up my uniform and put it in an interesting-looking bag. What struck me was not just the material, synthetic and very thin, clearly much more durable and flexible than paper. I was also intrigued by the words that were printed on it. Media Market. The bag must have served as packaging for that cretinous newspaper that I had spotted under the park bench. This proved that, deep down, the newspaper seller was a sensible man. He had kept the serviceable bag, but thrown away its infantile contents. Handing it to me, he explained the way to the cleaners and said perkily, "Hasta la vista, baby." This modern German would take some time to accustom myself to. I set off, albeit not directly to the cleaners. First, I went back to the patch of ground where I had woken up. In spite of my fortitude, I could not deny I harboured a faint hope that someone from my past had accompanied me into the present day. I found the park bench where I had taken my first rest, then crossed the street, very carefully this time, and made my way between the houses to the waste ground. It was late morning, and all was quiet. The Hitler youths were not playing. They were probably at school. The place was empty. Bag in hand, I gingerly approached the puddle beside which I had awoken. It had practically dried up. Everything was so quiet, or at least as quiet as it can be in a big city. There was the muted drone of automobiles in the distance, and I could also hear the buzzing of a bumblebee.
"Psst," I said. "Psst."
Nothing happened.
"Bormann,"
I called out softly.
"Bormann, are you there?"
A gust of wind whooshed across the terrain. An empty can knocked against another. Otherwise, nothing stirred.
"Keitel,"
I said.
"Goebbels!"
But there was no answer. Fine. In fact, it was better this way. The strong man is mightiest alone. An axiom as true now as it ever was. Indeed, it was truer than ever. I had greater clarity now, after all. It was my task, and mine alone, to save the Volk. Mine alone to save the earth and humankind. And the first step along this path led to the cleaners. Full of resolve, and bag in hand, I returned to my roots, to the place where I had learned the most valuable lessons of my life. The street. I carefully followed the directions I had been given, comparing terraces of houses and streets, checking, considering, cogitating, chancing.
my preliminary survey was rather positive. The country, or the city at least, seemed free of rubble and in good order. Overall, one might certify it satisfactorily pre-war. The new Volkswagens seemed to be performing reliably. They were quieter these days, albeit an acquired taste aesthetically. What stood out to my keen eye were the mystifying slogans covering every wall. Yes, I was familiar with this technique. In Weimar, especially, the communist accomplices used to daub their Bolshevist claptrap all over the place, and I myself had learned from this. But at least back then you could read the words painted by either side. Now I noted a large number of the messages. Their authors evidently regarded them as sufficiently important to deface the houses of honest citizens with them, were simply impossible to decipher. I could only hope that this was the brainchild of illiterate left-wing vermin. But as I kept going, I observed that the legibility of the slogans did not change from house to house, and therefore had to assume that important messages such as Germany Awake or Sieg Heil were possibly hiding amongst them too. Confronted with such ubiquitous dilettantism, I felt my blood boil. It was plain for all to see that what was missing here was firm leadership, tight organization. What made this particularly irksome was the fact that many of these writings had been produced with substantial colour and apparent effort. Or had the world in my absence developed a specific style of writing for political slogans? Determined to get to the bottom of the matter, I approached a lady who was holding a child by the hand. "Please, excuse me for bothering you, madam," I said. Pointing to one of the inscriptions, I asked, "Could you tell me what that says?"
"How should I know?" the lady said, giving me an odd look.
"So you find this writing rather strange, too?" I inquired further.
"Not just the writing," the lady said hesitantly. "Are you all right?"
"Worry not," I said. "I'm on my way to the dry cleaners."
"You'd be better off going to the barber's," the woman said.
I turned my head to the side, bent to the window of a newfangled automobile, and took a good look at myself. Although not impeccable, my parting appeared fine, and although my moustache would need a trim in a few days' time, for the moment a visit to the barber's was not essential. I took the opportunity to calculate that the following evening would be the most strategically advantageous for a more thorough body wash. Setting off again, I passed more of the same propaganda slogans, which might as well have been written in Chinese. The other thing that struck me was how many people seemed to be equipped with wireless receivers, an admirable number. Radar dishes were attached to windows everywhere, for receiving radio transmissions, no doubt. Were I to have the opportunity to speak over the radio waves, then winning over a new horde of staunch comrades amongst the Volk would be as easy as marching into Denmark. I had, after all, listened fruitlessly to a broadcast on the wireless, which sounded as if drunken musicians were playing, and announcers were babbling the very words that were smeared so illegibly on these walls. All I had to do was speak comprehensible German. Surely that would suffice. Child's play. Full of confidence and with a spring in my step, I strode on. Then, a short distance away, I saw the sign for Yilmaz Blitz Cleaners. This came as something of a surprise. Yes, all those newspapers had implied that there must be a large Turkish readership in the city, even if the circumstances of their arrival remained something of a mystery. And during my stroll, I had also noticed the occasional passer-by whose Aryan ancestry was questionable, to put it mildly, and not only 4 or 5 generations back, but right up to the last quarter of an hour. Even if it was still a mystery what exactly these racial aliens were doing here, at least they did not appear to be playing a leading role, which made it unlikely that businesses were being annexed by foreign types on a large scale and their names changed accordingly. As far as I was concerned, even for the purposes of economic propaganda,
It was hard to comprehend why anyone should want to christen a Blitz Cleaners with the name Yilmaz. Since when did Yilmaz represent the guarantee of clean shirts? At most, Yilmaz represented the guarantee of a serviceable donkey cart. The only problem was that I had no alternative to this cleaners. And given that rapidity of action was of the essence to allow me to exert pressure on my political opponents, I needed a Blitz Cleaners. Plagued by doubts, I marched in. I was greeted by a distorted glockenspiel. The place reeked of cleaning fluid, and it was sweltering. Far too hot for a cotton shirt, but the splendid Afrika Korps uniform was unavailable at present, alas. On the counter was one of those bells one often sees in hotel receptions. Nothing happened. I could make out some sort of plaintive oriental music. Perhaps in a back room of the shop, an Anatolian washerwoman was lamenting her faraway Heimat. Queer behaviour indeed, especially if one had the good fortune to live in the capital of the German Reich. I perused the items of clothing, which hung in rank and file behind the counter. They were wrapped in a transparent material, not dissimilar to the substance my bag was made of. In fact, everything seemed to be wrapped in this stuff. I had once seen something similar in a laboratory, but I.G. Farben must have come a long way with it in recent years. According to what I knew, the production of this material was highly dependent on a ready supply of crude oil. Correspondingly, it came at great expense. But the way in which synthetic materials were used here, indeed the extent to which automobiles were driven, suggested that crude oil was no longer a problem. Had the Reich somehow kept possession of the Romanian deposits? Unlikely. Had Göring ultimately discovered new sources on home soil? A bitter chuckle rose within my chest. Göring, that incompetent morphine addict! He would sooner find gold up his own nostrils than oil in Germany. I wonder what had become of him. It was more probable that we had fallen back on other resources, and been waiting long. A southern European man with Asiatic cheekbones peered out from a passageway at the back of the shop. Absolutely, I said impatiently. Why not ring? He pointed to the bell on his counter and tapped it gently with the palm of his hand. The bell rang. I did already ring. Here, I insisted, opening the door to the shop. The strange glockenspiel rang out once more. Must ring here, the cleaner said dismissively, hitting the bell on the counter again. A German only rings once, I said, prickly. Then here, the half-breed of indeterminate lineage said, ringing with his palm a third time. I was seized by the urge to send round the S.A. and have them lacerate this cretin's eardrum with his cursed bell, or even better, both eardrums. He could then explain to his customers to wave when they entered his establishment. I sighed. Being deprived of even the most basic auxiliary staff was downright annoying. A number of things would have to be put straight in this country before I could settle this matter to my satisfaction. But I started to compile a list of traitors sabotaging the future of the German folk, and Yilmaz Cleaners was at the very top. In the meantime, all I could do was scowl and remove the bell from his grasp. Tell me, I said harshly, do you clean things too? Or where you come from is the cleaning industry just about bell ringing? What you want? I placed my bag on the counter and took out my uniform. He took a sniff, said, Aha, you work at petrol station, and calmly picked up the bundle. I ought to have been indifferent to the opinions of a non-voter from an alien race, and yet I could not ignore what he said altogether. Granted, the man did not hail from here, but could I really have fallen into such obscurity? On the other hand, most of the German folk knew me from press photographs only, and these generally showed my countenance from a favourable angle. Meeting someone in the flesh is often surprisingly different. No, I said assertively. I do not work at the petrol station. I then turned my head upwards and to the side, offering the more photogenic angle to give the half-breed a clearer view of just who this was standing before him. The cleaner looked at me, more out of politeness than any apparent interest, but I received the impression that I was not entirely unknown to him. He leaned over the counter and studied my trousers, tucked impeccably into my high boots.
"I dunno. You famous fishing man."
"Just try a bit harder, man," I said forcefully, though feeling slightly deflated. Even with the newspaper seller, no genius himself, I was able to build on some prior knowledge. "Now this. How on earth would I make it back to the Reich Chancellery if nobody had a clue who I was?"
"A moment, please,"
the non-native fool said.
"I get sun. Always watch TV. Always look at internet. Know everything. Mehmet! Mehmet!"
The Mehmet in question soon appeared. A tall, moderately neat-looking youth shuffled to the front of the shop together with a friend or brother. The seed of this family was not to be underestimated. Both boys wore clothes that must have once belonged to brothers who were even taller. They must be truly gigantic. Shirts like bedsheets, unfathomably large trousers.
"Mehmet,"
his progenitor said, pointing at me.
"You know this man?"
I could detect a spark in the eyes of this boy, whom one could hardly call a boy any longer.
"Hey, man, yeah, of course. That's the bloke who always does the Nazi stuff."
Something, at least. There was no denying that his manner of expression was rather sloppy, but what he said was not altogether incorrect. "It is called National Socialism," I corrected him sympathetically. "Or National Socialist Policy, you could also say." My identity validated, I cast Cleaner Yilmaz a look of satisfaction.
"Is that Strongberg?"
Mehmet said confidently.
"Epic,"
his friend said.
"Stromberg in your laundry."
"Nah," Mehmet corrected himself.
"It's the other Strongberg, the one from the send-up."
"No way," the friend said. "The other Strongberg in your laundry."
I was keen to come back with a response, but was simply too exhausted. Who was I again? Petrol pump man? Fishing man? Strom man?
"Can I have an autograph?"
a delighted Mehmet asked.
"Yeah, me too, Herr Stromberg,"
the friend said.
"And a photo."
He waved a tiny instrument at me as if I were a dachshund and it a canine treat. It was infuriating. I took the receipt for my uniform, consented to have a souvenir photograph taken with these strange companions, and left the cleaners. But not before I had signed two sheets of tissue paper with the colour pen I was handed. A brief crisis followed the autographing, when complaints were aired that I had not signed Stromberg.
"Look, it's obvious,"
the friend said reassuringly, although it was unclear whether he was trying to placate Mehmet or me.
"That's not Stromberg."
"You're right,"
Mehmet agreed.
"He's not Stromberg, he's the other one."
I must concede that I had underestimated the enormity of the task facing me. Back then, after the Great War, at least I was the anonymous man from the heart of the Volk. Now I was Herr Stromberg. Not the first Stromberg, but the other one. The man who always did the Nazi stuff. The man who did not care which name he put on a sheet of tissue paper. Something had to happen. Fast. Chapter 6. Fortunately, something had happened in the meantime. When, lost in thought, I returned to the kiosk, I noticed two men in sunglasses talking to the newspaper vendor. They were wearing suits, but not ties. They were youngish, around 30 perhaps. The shorter of the two may even have been younger, but because of the distance between us, I could not quite tell. I was surprised that, despite his manifestly good-quality suit, the older man was unshaven. As I neared them, The newspaper seller beckoned me over excitedly.
"Come here, come here!"
Turning to the men, he said, "That's him. He's brilliant. He's mad. Puts all the others in the shade."
I refused to allow myself to be rushed. The true Führer senses at once when others attempt to seize control of a situation. When others say, "Quick, quick," the true Führer always endeavours to forestall an acceleration of proceedings and avoids being hurried into an error. How does he achieve this? By displaying prudence, while others scuttle around like headless chickens. Of course, there are moments in which speed is necessary. For example, when caught inside a blazing house, or when essaying a pincer movement to encircle a large number of English and French divisions and grind them down to the last man. But these situations are rarer than one might imagine, and in everyday life, prudence, always closely allied with keen resolve, holds the upper hand in the overwhelming majority of cases. Just as in the horror of the trenches, the survivor is often the man who strolls along the line with a cool head, puffing away on a pipe, rather than bustling back and forth like a washerwoman, snivelling all the while. Pipe smoking is naturally no guarantee of survival in a crisis. Pipe smokers have been killed in world wars too. Only a simpleton might assume that smoking a pipe would offer some sort of protection. On the contrary, survival is perfectly possible without a pipe, even without any tobacco at all. I, who have never smoked, am testament to that. Such were my thoughts as the newspaper vendor approached me impatiently. He practically shunted me like a mule over to the small conference. I may have appeared somewhat hesitant. Although not insecure, I would have felt more confident in my uniform. But nothing could be done about that now.
"Here he is,"
the newspaper seller repeated with uncustomary excitement.
"And these,"
he said, indicating the two men,
"are the people I told you about."
The older man was standing at one of the high tables. With one hand in his pocket, he was drinking coffee from a paper cup, a receptacle I had frequently seen used by workers over the past few days. The younger of the two put down his cup, pushed his sunglasses up to just below his short hair, which was styled with an excessive volume of cream, and said,
"So you're the boy wonder. Well, you need to work a bit at the uniform."
I gave him a brief, superficial glance and turned to the newspaper seller. "Who is this?" The vendor went red in the face.
"These gentlemen are from a production company. They make programmes for all the major channels, MyTV, RTL, Sat1, ProSieben, all the private ones. That's about right, isn't it?"
This last question was aimed at the two gentlemen.
"That is about right,"
the elder man said patronizingly. Then he took his hand from his trouser pocket and offered it to me.
"Sensenbrink, Joachim, and that's Frank Savatsky. He works with me at Flashlight."
"I see," I said, shaking his hand. "Hitler, Adolf." The younger one smirked, a rather haughty smirk to my mind.
"Our mutual friend has just been raving about you. Go on, say something, then."
With a grin, he put two fingers to his top lip and said in a strangled voice,
"We have been returning fire since 6:15.
I turned to the man and scrutinized him closely. Then I permitted a short period of silence to descend on proceedings. Silence is often underestimated.
"So," I said, "you wish to talk about Poland?"
"Poland? Fine.
What exactly do you know about the history of Poland?"
"Capital Warsaw, invaded 1939, divided with the Russians."
"That,"
I interrupted him,
"is merely what the books say. Any old half-wit could root that out. Answer the question!"
"But I..."
"The question! Do you not understand German, man? What do you know about the history of Poland?"
"I..."
"What do you know about Polish history? Do you know the contexts? And what do you know about the Polish racial mix? What do you know about Germany's so-called Poland policy after 1919?
And seeing as you mention returning fire, do you have any idea where?
I paused briefly to allow him to regain his breath. One must choose the apposite moment to crush one's political opponent. Not when he has nothing to say, but when he is attempting to say something.
If you heard my speech, then surely you must know how it continues.
I'm sorry? But, I mean, we're not.
Let me help you. Henceforth. Now, do you know how it goes? Henceforth, bomb will be met with bomb. Write it down. Maybe someday you will be interrogated again about great quotations in history. But perhaps you are better in the field. You have 1.4 million men at your disposal and 30 days in which to conquer an entire country. 30 days and no more. For in the West, the English and French are feverishly preparing for war. Where do you begin? How many army groups do you create? How many divisions does the enemy have? Where do you expect to meet the greatest resistance? And what do you do to prevent the Romanians becoming involved?
The Romanians?
Oh, excuse me, General. I'm most terribly sorry, sir. You are, of course, perfectly right. Who gives a fig about the Romanians? Naturally, Herr General here will always march to Warsaw, to Krakow. He does not look left, he does not look right. And why should he, by Jove? The Polak is a pushover. The weather is fine, the troops exceptional. But whoops! What is that? All of a sudden, the shoulder blades of our troops are shot through with tiny holes from which flows the noble blood of German heroes. And why? Because out of nowhere, millions of Romanian bullets have peppered the backs of hundreds of thousands of our infantrymen. But how can this be? How did this happen? Did our young general here maybe, possibly, perchance forget the military alliance between Poland and Romania? Were you ever in the Wehrmacht, man? With the best will in the world, I cannot picture you in the field. You could not find the way to Poland for any army on earth. You cannot even find your own uniform. I, on the other hand, can tell you at any hour, any minute, where my uniform is. I thrust my hand into my breast pocket and slapped the receipt on the table. At the cleaners!
A curious noise came from the older man, Sensenbrink, and two jets of coffee shot from his nostrils onto my shirt, the newspaper vendor's, and his own. The younger man sat there in bewilderment while Sensenbrink began to cough.
That, he wheezed, bent double under the table.
That was unfair.
He felt in his pocket, pulled out a handkerchief, and painstakingly liberated his respiratory passages.
I thought, he gasped. I thought at first it was going to be some sort of military skit, a bit like that Instructor Schmidt character. Oh, but the remark about the cleaners, that just killed me.
What did I tell you?
The newspaper seller said in jubilation.
Didn't I say the guy's a genius? And he is.
I was unsure how to interpret the coffee fountain and the comments that followed. Although I was not keen on either of these broadcasting types, the situation had been no different in the Weimar Republic. It was unavoidable that I would have to put up with weasels like these for a while. Besides, thus far, I had not said anything, at least not anything of what I had to say and was minded to say. Despite this, I detected a significant degree of approval.
You've grilled that burger to perfection, Sensenbrink said.
Classic. Set it all up, then wallop. Out with a punchline.
And it comes across as uber-spontaneous. But you prepared the routine in advance, didn't you?
Which routine?
The Poland routine. You're not going to tell me you did that off the cuff.
This Sensenbrink fellow actually seemed to possess a more profound understanding of the issue. One does not produce a blitzkrieg off the cuff either. Why? Maybe the man had even read his Guderian. Of course not, I said. The Poland routine had been planned down to the finest detail by June 39. Well, he asked, examining his shirt with a mixture of regret and amusement,
what other clubs have you got in your bag?
What do you mean, other? What clubs? What bag?
You know, a program, he said, or other texts.
I have written 2 books.
Extraordinary, he marvelled. Why didn't we pick you up on our radar years ago? How old are you, actually?
56, I said soberly.
Of course,
he laughed.
Have you got a makeup artist, or do you do it yourself?
Not usually, only when filming.
Only when filming.
He laughed again.
Excellent. Look, there are one or two people in our company I'd like to introduce you to. Where can I touch base with you?
Touch what? I asked.
Where can I get in contact with you?
He explained.
Here,
I said firmly. The newspaper vendor interrupted me, adding, I told you that his personal circumstances at the moment are a little unsettled.
Oh, yes, that's right,
Sensenbrink said.
You are, how should I put it, currently homeless?
For the time being, I am indeed without fixed abode, I conceded. But I'm certainly not without a Heimat.
I understand, Sensenbrink said, and turned to Savatsky. Well, that's no good, is it? Sort something for him. The man needs to sharpen his pencils.
I don't care how good he is. If he turns up in front of Frau Bellini looking like that, he'll be scrap metal before he can open his mouth. It doesn't have to be the Athlon, does it?
A modest dwelling will suffice, I said in agreement.
The Führer bunker was not exactly Versailles.
Excellent, Sensenbrink said. Do you really have no manager?
No what?
Forget it, he said, flapping his hand. That's settled, then. Now, I don't want to let the grass grow long on this one. We should try and diarise it this week.
You're going to get your uniform back soon, aren't you?
Maybe this evening, I reassured him. It is a blitz cleaners, after all.
Sensenbrink fell about laughing.
Chapter 7.
Even taking into account the dramatic events I had already experienced, the first morning in my new quarters was one of the most arduous in my life. The great conference at the production company had been delayed, which did not bother me. I was not so presumptuous as to deny that I had much work to do in familiarizing myself with this present era. By chance, however, I came across a fresh source for such information. The television set. The structure of this apparatus had changed so substantially since its initial development in 1936 that at first I simply failed to recognize it. To begin with, I assumed that the dark, flat plate in my room must be some bizarre work of art. Then, taking into consideration its shape, I speculated that it might serve as a means of storing my shirts overnight without them creasing. There were many things in this modern world to which I had to accustom myself, based as they must be on new discoveries or a passion for outlandish design. Now, for example, it was deemed appropriate to install a kind of elaborate washing galley for guests in place of a bathroom. There was no longer a bathtub, but the shower, a glass cabin, was more or less housed in the room itself. For several weeks I took this to be a sign of the modesty, nay, squalor of my billet, until I learned that in contemporary architecture circles these sorts of things are regarded as creative and remarkably progressive. Likewise, it was another coincidence which alerted me to the television set. As I had forgotten to hang the Do Not Disturb sign on the door to my room, a cleaner entered just as I was attending to my moustache in the washing galley. I turned around in surprise. She apologized, promising to return later, and as she was leaving, she caught sight of the apparatus my shirt was hanging in front of. "Is there something wrong with the telly?" she asked, and before I could reply, she picked up a small box and turned on the device. An image appeared at once, which changed each time she pressed the buttons on the box.
"Now it's working," she said, satisfied. "I just thought..."
Then she went, leaving me full of curiosity. Carefully, I took the shirt from the screen, then reached for the little box. So, this was a modern-day television set. It was black, with no switches or knobs, nothing. Holding the box in my left hand, I pressed button number one, and the apparatus started up. The result was disappointing. The picture was of a chef, finely chopping vegetables. Unbelievable! Having developed such an advanced piece of technology, all they could feature on it was a ridiculous cook! Admittedly, the Olympic Games could not take place every year, nor at every hour of the day, but surely something of greater import must be happening somewhere in Germany or even in the world. Shortly afterwards, a woman joined the man and provided an admiring commentary on his knife skills. My jaw dropped. Providence had presented the German folk with this wonderful, magnificent opportunity for propaganda, and it was being squandered on the production of leek rings. I was so furious that I could have hurled the entire apparatus out of the window. But then it occurred to me that there were many more buttons on the little box besides the simple on-off one. So I pressed number two. The chef vanished at once, only to be replaced by another chef, who was grandiosely discussing the differences between two varieties of turnip. This one had a floozy standing next to him too, who marvelled at the pearls of wisdom that fell from the lips of this turnip head. In irritation, I pressed number three. I had not imagined the modern world would be like this. Turnip head disappeared in favour of a thick-set woman who was also standing by a stove. Here, by contrast, the preparation of food was peripheral to the scene, nor did the woman announce what was on the day's menu. Instead, she complained that she had far too little money. This, at least, was good news for a politician. The social question had not been resolved in the past 66 years. Might one have expected anything better from those democratic windbags? I found it astonishing, however, that the television should afford this trout such prominence. Compared to a 100 meters final, the performance of the hefty whiner was terrifically uneventful. On the other hand, I was grateful to be watching a transmission where nobody was fussing over the cuisine, least of all the fat woman herself. Her concern was for a scruffy young character who now slouched up to her, muttered something that sounded like grumshi, and was introduced by a narrator as Mandy. Mandy, he explained, was the obese woman's daughter, and she had just lost her apprenticeship. As I sat there, wondering how anybody could have possibly given this Mandy an apprenticeship in the first place, I heard her categorically rejecting every meal she was offered as filth. As unsympathetic a character as this urchin must be, one could hardly be surprised at her lack of appetite, given the indifference with which her elephantine mother opened a box and carelessly tipped its contents into a pan. It came almost as a surprise that the box was not tossed in as well. Shaking my head, I switched again, to find a third chef chopping meat into small pieces and holding forth about how he held the knife and why. He too had a young blonde bint at his side, who nodded in admiration. Exasperated, I switched off the television set and resolved never to watch the thing again. I decided to hazard another attempt at the wireless instead. But after a thorough reconnaissance of my room, I established that there was no receiver present. If these modest quarters housed a television set but no wireless receiver, one had to conclude that the television had become the more important of the two media. Nonplussed, I sat on the bed. I grant that once I had been very proud of my ability, after years of independent study, to unmask with lightning clarity the Jewish lies concocted for the press, in no matter what guise they appeared. But here, my skill in that area was of no help. Here were only gibberish radio and cookery telecasts. What kinds of truths were being hidden? Were there lying turnips? Were there lying leeks? But if this was the medium of the age, which was indisputably the case, then I had no choice. I had to learn to understand the content of this device. I had to absorb it, even if it was as intellectually challenged and loathsome as the plump woman's boxed food. Full of resolve, I filled a jug of water at the washing galley, poured myself a glass, took a gulp, and, thus steeled, sat in front of the apparatus. I switched it on again. On the first program, the leek chef's preparations had come to an end. In his place, a gardener, marvelled at by a nodding strumpet, was discussing snails and the best way to combat them. Of considerable importance to the nutrition of the nation, true, but did it need to be the subject of a television transmission? Perhaps the reason it appeared so gratuitous was that, just a few seconds later, another gardener delivered the same speech almost verbatim, but on a different programme, this time in place of the turnip chef. My curiosity was now aroused as to whether the stout woman had also moved into the garden to take up the fight against snails rather than against her daughter. But this was not the case. Evidently, the television set had realised that I had been watching other broadcasts in the meantime, for a narrator now summarised what I had missed. Mandy, the narrator recapitulated, had lost her apprenticeship and did not want to eat her mother's food. The mother was unhappy. The same pictures I had seen only a quarter of an hour earlier were shown once more. All right," I said, loud enough for the television set to hear. "There's no need to do it at such length. I am not senile, for goodness sake." I switched programmes again, and in fact I encountered something new. The meat chef had vanished, and there were no preaching allotmenteers. Instead, they were showing the adventures of a lawyer, which seemed to be one of a series of telecasts. The lawyer had a beard like Buffalo Bill's, and all the actors spoke and moved as if the silent film era had barely ended. A very jolly piece of buffoonery, all in all, which made me laugh out loud on a number of occasions, even though in hindsight I was not entirely sure why. Perhaps it was mere relief that for once nobody was cooking or engaged in the defence of their salads. I switched over, now feeling almost confident in my mastery of the apparatus, and stumbled across more feature films. Apparently older, and with variable picture quality, they depicted farm life, doctors, detectives. But in none of them did the actors have the same bizarre quality as the Buffalo Bill lawyer. The general aim seemed to be to offer unadulterated daytime entertainment, which surprised me. Of course, I too was delighted when in 1944 The Punch Bowl was released, a wonderfully cheery film which enchanted and diverted the public at a particularly difficult time in the war. But this comedy had been consumed in the evenings, at least in the overwhelming majority of cases. How grievous the situation must now be, then, if the Volk was being offered up such a featherweight muse in the mornings. In shock, I continued my exploration of the device and was stopped dead in my tracks. Before me now sat a man who was reading from a text, which in content appeared to be a news bulletin, but this was hard to say with absolute certainty. For while the man presented his reports, banners ran across the picture, some with figures, some with phrases, as if what the announcer was saying were so negligible that one might as well follow the banners instead, or vice versa. What was certain was that one would suffer a stroke if one tried to follow everything. My eyes burning, I switched over again, only to find myself presented with a channel doing precisely the same, albeit with banners in another colour and a different announcer. Mobilising every last ounce of my inner strength, I spent several minutes attempting to grasp what was happening. A matter of some importance seemed to be the focus. The current German Chancellor had obviously proclaimed, announced, or decided something, but it was impossible to understand what. On the verge of despair, I crouched in front of the machine and tried to cover the inconsequential swarm of words with my hands so I could concentrate on the spoken word. But more gobbledygook was shifting constantly in almost every corner of the screen. The time, the stock prices, the price of the American dollar, the temperature of the remotest corners of the earth. Oblivious to all this, the announcer carried on broadcasting news of world events. It was as if the information were being retrieved from a lunatic asylum. And as if these nonsensical antics were not enough, interruptions for advertisements, as frequent as they were abrupt, declared where the cheapest holiday could be obtained, a claim, moreover, which a large number of shops made in exactly the same way. No sane person would be capable of remembering the names of these outlets, but they all belonged to a group called WWW. My only hope was that this was nothing more than strength through joy in a modern guise. Mind you, it was inconceivable that a man as intelligent as Lay could have created something which sounded like a frozen runt clambering out of a Lido with chattering teeth. Wuh-wuh-wuh. I do not recall how I was able to summon the strength to compose my own thoughts. And yet I was struck by a flash of inspiration. This organized lunacy was a sophisticated propaganda trick. It was plain to see. In the face of even the most dreadful news, the Volk would not lose heart, for the never-ending banners gave the reassuring message that it was legitimate to dismiss what had just been read by the announcer as insignificant, and concentrate on the sports headlines instead. I gave a nod of approval. In my time, we could have used this technology to inform the Volk of many things parenthetically. Not Stalingrad, maybe, but definitely the Allied landing in Sicily. And, conversely, when one's Wehrmacht won great victories, one could promptly remove the text banners and announce from a static screen, "Today, heroic German troops gave the Duce back his freedom." What impact that would have had! In need of a rest, I switched from this frenzied broadcasting and, out of curiosity, back to the fleshy mother. Had she sent her degenerate daughter to Borstal? What did her husband look like? Was he one of those lukewarm supporters who hid himself away in the National Socialist Motor Corps? The programme immediately recognised that I had returned to it and began hastily to outline events for me yet again. 16-year-old Mandy, the narrator recounted, now in a voice full of gravity and urgency, had lost her apprenticeship, and, when she came home, did not want to eat the food her mother had lovingly prepared for her. The mother was unhappy and had turned to a neighbour for help. "You haven't got very far," I scolded the reporter, but promised to look in again later on when more had happened. On my way back to the news channel, I paid another brief visit to Buffalo Bill, homage to the silent film. Another narrator greeted me there and informed me what the supposed lawyer had been up to till that point in the programme. It seemed that moral improprieties had taken place at the educational establishment frequented by 16-year-old Cindy. The search for the culprit, a pedagogue, led to a polyphony of excruciating nonsense. So ridiculous was this shoddy effort that I laughed heartily once more. Surely it needed an unctuous Jew to render this haphazardly cobbled-together hogwash even half credible. But where might one find a Jew these days? On this count, at least, Himmler had been as good as his word. I switched back to the chaos of the news and then switched further. I saw gentlemen playing billiards, which was now regarded as a sport, a fact which could be deduced, as I had discovered, from the name of the channel, which was fixed in an upper corner of the picture. Another channel was showing sport too, but here the camera captured people as they played cards. If this was modern sport, it made one fear for the fitness of the men undertaking military service. For a moment, I wondered whether someone like Leni Riefenstahl could have conjured more from such tedium. but even the art of the greatest geniuses of history has its limits. It may be that the manner of filmmaking had changed. During my search, I came across a few channels which were broadcasting something that superficially reminded me of the animated films of old. I still had a good recollection of the adventures of Mickey Mouse. But what I saw on the screen here was good for nothing more than inducing instant blindness. An endless succession of the most incoherent scraps of conversation was interrupted by an even more frequent injection of powerful explosions. In fact, the channels became ever queerer. There were some which broadcast only explosions without the animations. For a short while, I even suspected that this may be something like music, before coming to the conclusion that their sole aim was to sell an utterly mindless product called a ringtone. It was inexplicable to me why one should need a particular ring, as if everyone now worked in sound effects departments for talking films. Having said that, selling via the television set seemed to be a fairly common practice nowadays.